KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde. You think you know him? Red suit, white beard, jolly old elf. But what do you really know about the historic St. Nicholas? Adam English is the author of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. And Adam English is a professor at Campbell University in North Carolina, and he joins us now. Adam English, thanks so much for taking the time.
It's great to be with you on Christmas Eve.
So, Adam, there are always going to be doubters, but according to your historic account, St. Nicholas is, in fact, a very real person. What's the evidence for this historic St. Nicholas?
He's a very real person. I had the opportunity to study some archive libraries in Bari, Italy, which is where St. Nicholas is actually buried, and just accumulate documents from all across numerous years and numerous ports of evidence to really build and show the case for a historical person named Nicholas.
And when did the popular image of the Santa Claus we know today to also be real, when did that emerge?
You really have to go back to the early 19th century for the modern-day Santa Claus. In New York, certain prominent citizens like John Pintard and Washington Irving and those associated with the New York Historical Society are looking for Dutch roots, traditions, heritage, and to be Dutch is to celebrate St. Nicholas Sinterklaas, as he's known, to bake St. Nicholas cookies and to give gifts on December 6th, St. Nicholas Day. And so he gets imported into the American context by way of that Dutch tradition of Sinterklaas, of St. Nicholas.
Adam English is the author of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. Adam, when and where was the historic St. Nicholas born?
The original Nicholas of Myra was born around the year 260 in what is now the southern coast of Turkey, there on the Mediterranean Sea. And he lived his life out in that vicinity, lived a life of good works and generosity, which he's most known for today, and as a Christian bishop of that city of Myra.
And what was that city like at that time? And you said 260 A.D.?
Right. It was a Roman province of the Roman Empire. And when Nicholas was born, Christianity was a minority, persecuted, illegal religion. By the time of his death, it has not only been legalized, but become the favored religion of the Roman Empire. So he sees a massive shift in the perception of Christianity and in the makeup of the Roman Empire.
Adam English is a professor at Campbell University, and we're talking about his new book, The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. So what did Nicholas's parents do?
You know, we don't know that information, other than that they died when he was fairly young and left him a sizable inheritance, which he found ways to give away as part of his acts of generosity.
And I want to actually get to that story in a minute because it takes us to the present day in a lot of ways. But how do we know kind of about the details of his life? What was the sort of research project like for you? Who wrote about St. Nicholas?
This is where there is some clouds of doubt over his life and his personages. Nicholas himself did not leave any written records, and none of his contemporaries wrote about him. Which is not so surprising when you think about a 3rd, 4th century character. So the earliest information we have about him comes from 200 years after his death. And so you have to then treat that material very carefully to really unroot the historical person underneath kind of the layers of legend that have already started to evolve around him 200 years later.
And these were hagiographies that you looked at to try to uncover some of that. What is a hagiography?
A hagiography is the life of a saint, writing about a saint. Today, of course, the term hagiographic or hagiography tends to mean that it's legendary or inflated in some way. But at the time when people wrote about saints, back then that was not necessarily the case. But again, think about writing about an individual 200 years after he's already died. Yes, there's already some legend associated with every detail of his life. So the hard work of the historian is to go back and really scrape some of that off and find the historical person underneath.
Adam English is a professor at Campbell University, and his new book is The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. Adam English, what was life like for him as a child? What was it like for kids at that time?
It was a rough existence. Childhood and adolescence is definitely a modern concept. The death rate among children and infants was so high that really not a lot of love and care and warmth was given to children. He had an education. They had schooling back then, but a warm, fun childhood he did not have, and no one really had at that time.
Was he educated?
Yes. Yeah. We have evidence that he received education, and that from his earliest youth he was reared in a Christian home. Saint Paul from the Book of Acts in the Bible had visited Patera, which is the city of Nicholas's birth, and also visited Myra, the city of Nicholas's bishopric, and had founded churches there. So Christianity was very ancient in those cities already by his life.
You mentioned earlier that his parents died when he was pretty young, when he was just 18 years old. What happened to him next?
Next he seeks what to do with his life. He already very dedicated to the church, and there is a wonderful story about what he does with his inheritance. He's looking around for something to do with it, and hears of a man in town who has lost everything. He's on the brink of destitution, and he's become so desperate he's decided perhaps to even sell his three daughters into prostitution. Nicholas decides to do something about it, bagging up some of that gold, and in the middle of the night, anonymously passing by the man's house and tossing a bag in. It's found in the morning, and the gold is used as a dowry so that one of those daughters might be able to marry out of her condition. Nicholas, seeing the results, returns two more times to provide two more dowries for the other two daughters to marry out. And there you have, the nugget of the Santa Claus story, the visit. It's an inspiring tale, and it already immediately in Nicholas's day began to inspire people to give gifts anonymously. So the December 6th has always been associated with a day of gift giving, and it's carried down to our own time of gift giving on the 25th.
So it's easy to see this thread. Here's this mysterious visitor in the middle of the night who comes to give gifts to children. But this is also a story about prostitution. How common was it at the time for a father to decide to sell his daughters into prostitution?
It's a shocking detail, but it's fairly common. And we know that partly by the legislation. The Roman emperors and the Senate continuously outlawed doing this, which indicates to us that it was a common practice, that people were forced into the situation. If your options are starvation or freeze to death or make money by any means you can, you see the choices people had.
Adam English is a professor at Campbell University in North Carolina, and his new book is The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. So Nicholas isn't a saint at this point. Is he, as Nicholas at least, judgmental of this man for having decided to sell his daughters into prostitution?
No, but that aspect does interestingly come into his thinking. He is not only wanting to save the girls, of course, but he wants to save this man from this decision, from the shameful, horrific decision. So that does interestingly weigh into his decision. Nicholas is still a young man at this time, not yet a bishop or a pastor or anything like that, and does this. And I think partly what's so wonderful about this story is it is a story of ordinary goodness. I mean, this is the kind of thing anybody could do, giving a simple gift to save someone in need. So they're already by the 1100s, we have nuns in France who are making little gifts, little toys, and leaving them on the doorsteps of children and signing them from St. Nicholas. It's an inspiring kind of act precisely because, hey, this is, anybody can help out their neighbor like this, and isn't this what we should be doing anyways?
And why was that sort of moral message so significant at the time?
Significant for, so many reasons. Partly because the other saints, of course, we have other saints from that era, you know, but many of them are known for dying grisly deaths as martyrs, for performing supernatural miracles. You know, but here Nicholas was doing something kind of as a Christian that was an ordinary act of goodness, you know, especially in a time when people did not have, you know, big government subsidized, you know, options for, you know, welfare or whatnot. So they really lived this day-to-day scarce existence. And for Nicholas to do this would have been just remarkable at the time.
And yet you write that this isn't necessarily the story that he was most well known for at the time, that there were other stories, including one about how he becomes the patron saint of prisoners. What was that story?
Right. There's other stories about Nicholas later on in life saving three innocent men from beheading and from a false judgment, and visiting prisoners in prison. We have other stories about him bartering with grain ships to procure grain for the people of Myra from starvation. He travels to the capital to petition the government for lower taxes. And so, you know, what was interesting to me about Nicholas, I had, of course, expected to find stories of generosity, but to find stories of him really acting as a social activist, someone who was out there kind of really working for the people, that was amazing.
And so what was one of those stories? What's one of the most oft-told one at the time?
Really, the most oft-told one was this one about him saving three innocent men from beheading. It's a story that involves Roman soldiers making dock at Myra, and a riot almost breaks out. Nicholas settles the riot, and then these three innocent men are nearly beheaded, and Nicholas, you know, barges into this public square and takes the sword away and goes and confronts the judge about, you know, this misdeed. And so oftentimes the most common representation of Nicholas was Nicholas visiting these prisoners. And so on church walls and in paintings and in stained glass, he was most often represented visiting these three men. Later, legend then would look at this image of Nicholas visiting these three men in prison and see in it maybe not three men, but three little children, and maybe not a jail cell, but perhaps a barrel. And so we have another story developing of Nicholas then resurrecting three butchered children from a pickling barrel, which is such an odd story, but if you think about how that might have looked in a picture to them of Nicholas visiting these three men in jail, then you can start to see where that comes from. So sometimes today you hear people telling stories of St. Nicholas, how he resurrected three butchered children from a pickling barrel. Like, where did that come from? It's from that story.
Well, all right. I just want to ask one more question. If you had to sum it all up, how does the story of the historic St. Nicholas that you looked at compare to the story of Santa Claus that's planning to come down your chimney tomorrow, you know, assuming you've been good?
You know, I love Santa Claus traditions, and I have nothing against the Santa Claus. What Nicholas does when we reinvite Nicholas into the home and tell his story, not only do we have a real story of generosity, but, you know, Nicholas is giving gifts to people he doesn't know, people who are simply in need. And so, you know, what I would love to see long term is to add to our Santa Claus traditions, our gift-giving traditions to family members and friends, a tradition of giving gifts to our neighbors, to people we don't necessarily know, to people who are in need in our community, and doing it as a St. Nicholas gift, you know, kind of in the spirit of St. Nicholas. I think that would be a great way to enrich the holiday season.
All right, Adam English, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Adam English is an expert on the historic St. Nicholas and a professor at Campbell University in North Carolina. The name of the book is The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. As you know, Santa has to visit billions of children in a single night, and that may sound impossible, but it's not, according to astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. He spoke earlier with NPR's David Greene.
Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer, as we all know, has a very shiny nose. And so would you if you were at the head of a team of reindeer bolting across the night sky, helping Santa deliver Christmas presents to 2 billion children in a single night. Now, to help us understand how Santa manages to pull this off every year, we're joined by a friend of this program, astrophysicist and science guru, Professor Neil deGrasse Tyson. And happy holiday to you, Professor Tyson. Thanks for coming on again.
Thank you. You know, you guys ask me about everything, man.
Well, you know everything. I mean, what do you want it from us to do? Well, this will be particularly interesting, I think, to a lot of people, because it's, I'm sure that Santa employs some Christmas magic that's beyond our understanding to get all this done. But there must be some science involved, too, right?
Well, a couple of things. Let's back up for a minute. So Rudolph's nose.
Right.
Now, to me, the word shiny means it reflects light. If you only reflect light, that's not really good to lead the way through the darkness of the night.
Because there's no light to reflect.
You have to radiate light. So let's presume that his nose actually radiated red light. Well, it turns out red light is ideal for getting through foggy, cloudy nights.
Huh.
Because red light penetrates through fog better than blue light. And that's why, for example, they don't want you to put on your brights when you're driving through fog. The brights are bluer than your low beams. So the fact that Rudolph have a red nose, that's awesome.
You're saying Santa found the right reindeer.
Yes, he did. Rudolph's brother who had a blue nose? No, that would not have worked.
You know, Santa has to go really, really, really fast to get to all these places in the world. I mean, is there a sense for what he's doing?
Okay, so now, yeah. So it turns out if he traveled the speed of light, you know, light can encircle the Earth 7 times in 1 second.
7 times in a second, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Light is awesome. Problem is, we all live within Earth's atmosphere. So if you could go that fast through the atmosphere, then you'll just burn up. And I'd learned from speaking to an expert in comic book heroes that the Flash has atmospheric separators in front of him when he goes quickly from one place to another so that he does not burn up.
So Santa could have atmospheric separators in theory.
He could have atmospheric separators. So now you can go keep doing this calculation and have him go to every home. So I realized that what he really needs is that what they have in that movie Monsters, Inc.
Yeah.
Do you remember that movie where
I do, but remind
they just
me.
Manufactured doors? And the door in the Monsters, Inc. factory is the door of the children's closet. And you just carry the door home with you. You go through that door and you show up in the kids' closet and terrorize them in their sleep because they're monsters, of course.
And if he can go in these secret doors in all the houses that don't have chimneys, I mean, he's able to travel magically into a lot more homes.
Yeah, so in that point, it's not magic. What Monsters, Inc. never told you is that they're essentially wormholes.
So it is possible that he's just up there doing kind of a lap around the Earth to kind of do the photo shoot. And he's actually delivering all these presents in some other way using wormholes and other devices.
Yeah, he could be up there just for show. Uh-huh. Now, you know NORAD, right?
The military folks who track flying objects.
Yes, these are the folks that track missiles coming in from the Cold War threat.
Yeah.
After the Cold War, you know, they said, well, what else are we going to do? So December 24th, you go to the NORAD website and they track Santa from the North Pole. And you can know where Santa is at all times.
You know what's really interesting about all this? This could explain why the kids have never been able to catch him coming down the chimney. I mean, maybe he's got the kids distracted by that, and he's actually getting in some other way.
You know, that's brilliant. That's brilliant, because he has to keep telling people to look at the chimney, and then he sneaks in another way. He creates a distraction.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.